I'm going to tell you a story that I gave probably years and years ago. I think I preached the next day after this happened, okay? But Kelsey and I, we were still, within our first year of marriage. We were over at Camarillo Oaks. There's an apartment complex just down Paseo Camarillo. I feel like everybody gets their start right on that road in Camarillo. Everybody starts there and then branches out, all right? So we got our start there and then branched out. Nice little community. Zach and Ellen Snow lived kind of across the diagonally from us, and cool people around us. But then one day we get a knock on the door. It's a Saturday afternoon. Now, Kelsey goes to school during that time from Monday through Friday. She'd drive down to Biola in L.A. and drive back up. So Saturday was don't do anything day, essentially. So she could do work. I would hang out around the home, or we'd maybe do something at night. And so it's a lounging, lazy Saturday, and we get a knock on the door. And I open it up, and it's a guy in slacks and a button-up T-shirt with a kind of a smile on him. I'd say smirk, not smile, smirk. And he hands a card. We're a new company in town that does carpet cleaning. Can we give you a demonstration or a demo on your carpet? And so we see our carpet. It's not new when we moved in. Someone only lived there a year, and so stains were starting to come up. So instantly, let's do it, okay? Now, some of you might go like, no, what did you just do? Now, we were naive, okay? Here's where the story comes in. I forget about it. It's probably 3 hours had gone by. That was in the morning or early morning, about 10 or something. Gone about our day. I'm watching college football, minding my own business, and then the knock comes on the door again. Open it up. Here's a guy with another guy and with their vacuum cleaner, okay? And I think, sweet, it's going to happen. And I ask, what do I need to move? Let's do this big room if you can. Oh, we'll get to that, but first, can we tell you about our vacuum cleaner? Now, little did I know, I had no idea what the name Kirby was. Now, some of you in here might be like, Kirby vacuum cleaners, you would have smelled that a mile away and said, no thanks. Here's me being naive. I have no idea. And so for the next 3 hours, we begin told how great a Kirby vacuum cleaner was. 3 hours of my life I will never get back, and I am still bitter about it, if you will. The first hour and a half was kind of cool because this vacuum cleaner was doing everything it said it would, all right? I was really impressed. In fact, I was just focusing on, like, how does all this work? I want to take it apart and look at it. But by that hit that hour and a half mark, I was, let's get out of here, buddy. I want my Saturday back. You stole it. You just said it was a you wanted to clean my carpet, but that was a lie. And you knew it. That's what that smirk was for. You knew you were tricking me, and I just had no idea. And so here's the end of the story. It's kind of funny. This guy is obviously within his first time doing it. So the main guy leaves and probably goes somewhere else, and he leaves this guy doing the Kirby vacuum cleaner. Does a great job, essentially telling us how bad we are at cleaning, which is always fun to see, and how much dirt lives everywhere around us. And but he's so tired. He's just dripping sweat. He's not used to doing this. And Kelsey, it's getting close to dinner time. She thinks, all right, we got to eat some food. So she starts prepping dinner. This guy invites himself to dinner. He's so hungry and desperate. Like, I just need to eat. I haven't had anything in hours. And we're left with this response. See, this whole time, some of you would sit there, why would you let that go on? Why don't you just kick him out of your house? Well, I thought that same thing. But then there's me, a 22, 23-year-old, wanting to be a good Christian guy and share the gospel, say, how do I not do this and be mean about it? How do I kick this guy out? Do I listen? Do I share the gospel to him? He's obviously hurt and he's having a hard time. And he didn't really care about listening to the gospel, hearing anything that. He's just trying to make some money selling a vacuum cleaner. We didn't buy it, just end of the story. We didn't buy it. A, you don't have enough money. And I just kept telling him, like, dude, that's a lot of cash, like $1,000 or more money for a vacuum cleaner. No way. And so I left with this bitterness in my heart. I came to church the next day. I think I was preaching, to be honest. So I had that on my mind, and I was just so upset. I got tricked. I got duped, and I wanted to let this guy know. Like, I want another Kirby person to come to my door just so I can have some revenge and get back. Oh, I'll show them. I don't know if I'll really ever do anything. When people come to your door, how do you respond? When they come to your place of living where you feel comfortable, when they enter into your world, how do you respond? Is there a godly response? Absolutely. Is there an ungodly response? Absolutely. And when the Kirby people were there, I was telling you, that's where my mindset was. What is the right response? I'm angry and upset. I want my Saturday back. But I have the gospel. This guy is hurting. Who knows why he's here? Now, I didn't really share the gospel with him. By that time, I just want him out of the house. So that was well overshadowed. However, you and I encounter people that enter into our world or come close to this church world or the Christian world. They come in contact with it. They come close to God. They get a glimpse of him. They get an idea of him and his characteristics, and there's a response from them. But what is our response to their response, if you can follow that train? This morning, as we look into Joshua, we're going to see a group of people who have come in contact with God and his ways, and they're responding positively to some degree. Although deceptive, just like the Kirby people, they're tricking God's people, and yet there is still a godly response we can have. There is still a heart of God we can convey. And so as we jump into this message in Joshua chapter 9, I want us to review our head, our heart, our decisions. How do we respond to the world around us as it responds to God? For the most part, I think we all jump into one category. The world is against us and against God, so we respond to them with some form of hostility or defense. This morning, I'd like to expand that. Rather than a simple hostility or defense or we're under the attack, let's flesh it out. Let's look at a bigger response that we can have, one that God led his people to have, and us by extension. Before we do that, why don't you guys pray with me? Heavenly Father, I ask for your help this morning to teach. So Spirit, please teach us and encourage us. Give us the right insight. Open our head and our heart to receive your truth and to be your people that honor you, that glorify you, and that do a good job of bringing people into the family. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen. So this morning, if you're in Joshua chapter 9, let me give you a little recap, all right? We have to give a little context to where their head and heart is at before they encounter these people that are kind of seeking God in their own way. Not in our way, but in their own way. So the nation of Israel had this utter defeat. They've experienced God's wrath, but they've come out of it. They've turned away from their own heart and desires and turned their attention to the Lord. And they had this great victory at Ai. They defeated a whole city and a whole people. And their response to that is a godly response. Instead of partying on their own, they center themselves and their understanding that God has blessed them. God has restored them. God has given them a victory. They read all of God's law. They set their heart in the right direction. They are in a good spot. Coming into chapter 9. And they're probably with this mindset, we want to continue doing this. We don't want to fall away. We know what that's like. Let's not do it. What do we need to do to not fall away? And so we come into chapter 9 probably and most likely with a people who are concerned with the Lord and his ways and doing what's right. And now we come to this interesting interaction. When God's people want to do what's right, and they're following through, and they're being obedient, and they're living out that calling, the world that doesn't know God is going to get a glimpse of him. And because of that, people respond to God differently. And we get two main responses here. Look with me in Joshua chapter 9, verse 1 and 2. As soon as all the kings who were beyond the Jordan, in the hill country and in the lowland along the coast of the great sea toward Lebanon, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites heard this. They gathered together as one to fight against Joshua and Israel. Joshua and Israel are God's emissaries. They're his people. And so they're carrying out his will. Their actions and attitudes are extension of God in the world. And so most of the people begin to defend their rebellion. They gather together. We need to fight against this God we're coming in contact with. Now, from their standpoint and their view, what are they seeing? They're seeing essentially an invader come in and destroy their way of life. Their very existence is threatened, and so they're acting out of defense. But defense of what? Their rebellion, their life apart from God. Today in our world, most people would fall under this. People are fighting back, defending their rebellion. What would fall underneath this? Well, certainly a head-on violence, attacking God and his ways and his people. That's what's intended here. But there's some other ways that are defending the rebellion. Avoidance and indifference is a defense mechanism. To say it doesn't exist or it's not there or it doesn't really matter. See, it can take many forms. But that's not the only response. Most people will hear God, his ways, and want nothing to do with it and stay in their own. But we see a different response. Look at me in verse 3. And here comes some of our main characters. But when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and to Ai, They, on their part, with cunning, and went and made ready provisions and took worn-out sacks with their donkeys and wineskins, worn out, torn and mended, with worn-out patches of sandals on their feet, worn-out clothes, and all their provisions were dry and crumbly, and they went to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal. So these people had a different response. They've heard of all the destruction that has been preceding them, and now Joshua and the army, now it's their turn. They're next at the front line. Okay? The battle line, the western front, if you will, is right at their doorstep. Now we need to act. We either go gather with all of these kings, or we do something different. And they chose differently. They chose, we need to go to Joshua and make peace. But how do they do that? How do they make peace with an army that is looming and threatening, that has destroyed everybody ahead of them? And we're going to find out they have, and they have God's word, they have his promise as to why they're doing it and what they're called to do. So in their mindset, they already know we're supposed to die and be destroyed, so we need a way out of this. It's an interesting response when people come in contact with God. There are those who want nothing to do with him or want to ignore him or fight him and hate him for who he is. And there's others who get a glimpse of him more often than not, and they try to seek some understanding about him. They try to reconcile some differences, the way they've grown up, the way they think, and the way God is. But in that reconciliation, we see it from one point of view as people of God who know his ways, what he likes. We know what a Christian looks like and the way they act and what they think and the words they say. And then those on the other side of the fence, though, they don't have that. And so when they're coming in contact with God, getting to know him, reacting to his actions and attitude in this world, they're going to use whatever tools, attitudes, actions that they have. And so look at what they come up with. We need to make peace. We need to escape this judgment. We need to escape this destruction. So we're going to trick them. I'm not confident that Joshua would hear us. Rightfully so. This is a time of war. And so how are we going to convince him of our message to spare us? They're not that far away. Gibeon is actually 6 miles northwest of Jerusalem. So it's really not that far a distance. And so if they come up with nice clothes, obviously they're going to be turned away, shown as spies, not be treated with, not given an opportunity to speak. So they just throw on the old, dirtiest, rattiest clothes they got. I have a pair. You probably have your work clothes that you know when you're working outside or doing something around, your painting clothes, you have them. They are there. My dad, I've grown up with my dad having his paint jeans. I feel like those are the only ones I ever saw him wear. We'd go out and do fun things. As a family, we would, even when we would go to prom pictures in high school, my dad would still be wearing those ratty old jeans. Everybody else would be dressed up looking nice. It's not a big deal. Let's just say that's my dad. He really didn't care. But you can imagine them coming to Israel, we're going to look like we've came from a faraway land. We're going to deceive them. Now here we have an interesting word. It says cunning. With cunning they went. It's an interesting phrase because we have to ask the person who's writing this, is that meant to be interpreted positively or negatively? Obviously, it's sin. I'm not saying deception is any regard good. But we have to ask ourselves, is this part of what they can, is this all they can do? When you and I come in contact with people, I have to stress that when we start speaking our Christian language and our Christian world and our Christian ways, it's very foreign to the outside world. It's threatening to some degree. People don't like to feel inferior, or to seem they don't measure up or not good enough. And so usually when I go to teach, especially in high school and youth group, I made it a point to try to use just common vernacular. And especially when I was teaching at the high school in town for their Christian club, I found even my trying wasn't good enough. It is so ingrained in me, Christian words, Christian ways, Christian ideals. It's hard to escape. And so when we look at these people and how they're coming to Joshua, are we quick to make an judgment, an assessment that would write them off? Or we need to open our mind a little bit to however someone comes in contact with the Lord, we need to be open to how they come, rather than just cut off the line of communication and desire, because they may be coming in the best way they know how. Are we going to respond with a godly response? So let's look at what happens with the people. How does the nation of Israel respond to this deception that comes their way? They have no idea about it. but they still respond in a positive note. It's wartime. There might be spies, just like Joshua sending out, so we have the first response. We exemplify discernment. If we're going to respond properly to all people, we need to exemplify discernment. Think through our actions and what's around us. Look at the second part of verse 6. In the camp at Gilgal, and they said to Joshua and to the men of Israel, "We have come from a distant country, so now make a covenant with us." But when the men of Israel said to the Hivites, "Perhaps you live among us, then how can we make a covenant with you?" There's this question and answer. Hey, you look the part, but how do we know for sure? We want to make sure there's not a wolf slipping in to destroy, to spy out our freedom, to enslave us again. Same thing goes in the church when people are coming into it. Yeah, there's a healthy skepticism, not saying we need to skepticize everything, but to look at the situation and ask, why are you here? And then Joshua gives us a really good question to ask. Then said to Joshua, verse 7, "We are your servants." And Joshua said to them, "Who are you and where do you come from?" That phrase, "who are you," is a much deeper word than just your name. It's your legacy. What's your background? What have you gone through to get here? What are you like? What's your culture like? What do you find normal? All wrapped up in the who. He's asking, what is your people's name? We are the people of Israel. You are what? That's kind of an interesting concept. We like to say, what family are you from here? Growing up, there are, and even in this church, you could say the name of a family in here, and it would bring a response based on the kids and the family, the legacy, the clan, if you will. That same thing's going on here. What's your clan like? What's the reputation? And then last question he asked, and where do you come from? He's trying to find out the nature because he wants to follow God. He wants to do the right thing. Verse 9, then he said to him, this is the Gibeon's response, "From a very distant country, your servants have come because the name of the Lord your God, for we have heard a report of him and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon, the king of Heshbon, and to Og, king of Bashan, who lived in Ashroth." Fun names, obviously. Joshua hears something that gets his attention. He's asking who and where, and they blow right by that. They don't even give credence to that. Let's skip that question, because that's obviously going to expose their deception. Let's move right on. And they begin to reveal their heart. They are saying the truth of their heart in a deceiving way, but their heart, it's in the right place for the most part. What do they say to him? And this is what tickles his ear. "We fear God. We've heard what he's done, and we're responding. I don't know what to do to escape this, but we've heard this, and we don't want it to be us." When reading this for the first time, and kind of wrapping my head around it, I thought about my friends, how they've asked me about God. They ask in words and phrases that are familiar and comfortable to them. So, for instance, a friend would say, "Hey, in the church, how do you guys party in the church?" Now, you hear that, and you go like, "Well, that sounds kind of weird. We don't really party in the church as you would think." What's he really asking? "Hey, how do you guys have community in the church? How do you enjoy one another's company? What do you do?" We call that fellowship. But that word means nothing to them on the outside. And so they're coming with this. And this trickery, this guise, this cunning, it is sin. I'm no longer saying that. But can we move beyond that and see the heart? And what's the heart? "I heard of this God, and I know I need to do something about it." The world around us, probably when they come in contact with God, are they saying the same things, and we're just missing it? To where our ears can't hear them say. So when my friends said, "Hey, how do you and your friends party in the church?" I could easily say, "Dude, we don't drink, we don't do stuff like that, it's not our parties." What's he really asking? "Oh, this is how we find joy and encouragement as a family." And we begin to share and open communication with him. But they keep pressing a little bit more. They keep calling themselves their servants. "We too, like you, Israel, we want to be your servants. Anybody that is a servant of God is a child of his." Verse 13, they kind of give the home run to their argument. They say, "Look how we've come. Worn out clothes, worn out wineskins. Look at everything that is before you. Look at the discernment that these people get to use. They get to use all the details. But then we come to verse 14. So the men, this is Israel, so the men took some of their provisions, but did not seek counsel from the Lord. And Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them. Let them live, and let the leaders of the congregation swore to them. There was a sin of omission here. Discernment was excellent. Asking the right questions was great. Looking for the right things, in that these are God-fearers. They have some respect for God, just like Rahab. Rahab heard what God has done, and she sought mercy from him. And so all these are lining up, but they forgot one important thing: to involve God in the process. Involving God in the process will help this discernment come to its ultimate conclusion, that we get the blessing of his perspective as opposed to ours. Now, I'm going to get to this. I'm going to come back to this at the end as we recap the whole thing. Because I think because of them not asking the counsel of the Lord, they create more problems for themselves. And they ultimately miss out on God's blessing to be a part of this welcoming in of new people. Instead, because they didn't counsel the Lord, we come to verse 16. And we come with a new thing with responding to people. Our godly response must be to keep our word. Verse 16, at the end of 3 days, after they had made a covenant with them, these are the Gibeonites, they heard that they were neighbors and that they lived among them, and the people of Israel set out to reach their cities on the third day. Now their cities were Gibeon, Cherethim, I always have a hard time, Beeroth, Kiriathjearim, and the people of Israel did not attack them because the leaders of the congregation had swore to the Lord of Israel. And then, here's an interesting thing, then all the congregation murmured or grumbled or became upset against the leaders. And so they were duped. They were tricked. I can't imagine the people and the leaders in that moment, probably a huge, way bigger than my Kirby experience once I realized what was going on with me, being tricked and trying to sell something, giving me something different than what I originally intended. And so the people rightfully were upset. And instead, usually they're upset and it's wrong. They were upset and it was good because they have something in their recent past. They have done something against God and now they get his wrath. And now they get his punishment. So these people are sitting in the midst of this wrongdoing, wondering, probably, what's coming for us now? You guys have screwed up. What's going to happen to us? And so they're left with this predicament. Israel has dug a hole for themselves. Now they have two options. As it's going on to say, we either get revenge on them and kill them like God has called us to do. These people are devoted to destruction. God has called us to do that, so we screwed up there. But we also screwed up because we made an oath to them. And here's a unique concept to the oath. Verse 19. But all the leaders of the leaders said to all the congregation, "We have sworn to them by the oath, the Lord, the God of Israel, and now we may not touch them. We will do to them, this we will do to them. Let them live, lest wrath be upon us because of the oath that we swore to them." And the leaders said to them, "Let them live." So on one hand, we've wronged because we were supposed to destroy them. On the other hand, we've now created a promise and we attach God's name to it. And so if we go back on that promise, we dishonor God, and now we're going to get wrath. We're on a rock and a hard place. What do we do? Again, they didn't seek the counsel of the Lord on this. But they do recognize something unique. And this is what we don't understand about oaths and promises. Back then, think of it as your credit score or your resume for your job or your future and the people you live around. Your oath was your witness. Your oath and what you would attest to, normally how it worked, if you wanted to make a promise, you would attest to someone of greater authority and power than you. And if you break that oath, that higher authority and power can do with you what they wish concerning that oath that you broke. And so this is where Israel finds himself in the hard place. For fear of God's wrath, they say, "We're going to let them live. We've screwed up." But here's something interesting that I think comes out of that. They recognize that their word and what they have to say represents God. It honors him. Think of it this way. Our word is our witness. The certainty of our word will convey the certainty of our message. If the things I say and the things I do and the things I promise I never fulfill on or go through with, who's to say when I speak the gospel that that's actually true and worth going after? This is why Jesus, and he tells us in Matthew chapter 5, verses 37 and, or excuse me, 35 and 36, he says, "And do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair on your head white or black. Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil." Jesus is kind of revealing our heart. We can't just be simple people of yes and no, and we got to attest to something. There is a bigger problem and concern to our heart. Which is what James says in chapter 5, verse 12. "Above all, my brothers, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation." Is your yes, yes, and is your no, no? But this was always a tough thing for me, even starting here. I would never write things down. So I'd say I'd do something or prepare for something, and then I would always forget, or I wouldn't remember to do it. Inevitably, my yes was not really good. And so my message that I would teach isn't really good. It's tainted in the world outside of us as they're interacting with us, as these nations, they're interacting with the nation. Even though they did something wrong, even though they sinned and deceived, God is still going to be honored. We will keep what we say because this is the God we serve. Our God fulfills his promises. If he has promised something, he will bring it to fruition. I believe that, and so I'm going to demonstrate it. But there are consequences to the sin of deception. That although they're going to keep this oath and honor God and have their yes be yes and their no be no, they're going to hold to it. But because of that, look at verse 21. "And the leader said to them, let them live. So they became cutters of wood and drawers of water for all the congregation, just as the leaders had said to them." So here's a little catch. You tricked us. Ha ha, joke's on us, I get that. But because this treaty will last forever, there is no end date to this, your punishment, your consequence for doing so must be equal to that. Not greater, not less. And so essentially what he's saying, you will be our servants. You will do manual labor, menial tasks. You will serve this role. You will cut wood and you will fetch water. That's what your people will be to us. And so we think about it. That's kind of interesting. When people come in contact with the church, I don't think there's a huge crossover here. Like, oh, let's give them menial tasks. Although, wait a minute, there may be something there to that. Something simple, something that they can find and be a part of the body, serve a purpose. So God's people keep their word, but here's the next interesting concept. Now they come in contact with Joshua, and he displays God's people should be known by their mercy. Verse 22, Joshua summoned them, and he said to them, "Why did you deceive us, saying that we are very far from you when you dwell among us? Now therefore you are cursed, and some of you shall never be anything but servants, cutters of wood, drawers of water for the house of my God." They answer Joshua, and here's what we get their heart. "Because it was told to your servants for a certainty that the Lord your God had commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you. So we feared greatly for our lives because you and did this thing." We're afraid. We didn't want to die. We didn't want to be destroyed. But what other option did we have, Joshua? We came with you with what we had, with what we knew, the only thing that we would think would work. I'm very quick to judge. I am. First impressions are a really big thing. I don't like it. That's just me. If first impression happens and all of a sudden my mind's there, you might find yourself in the same shoes. When I put myself in Joshua's shoes, what's my first impression of these Gibeonites now? They're not to be trusted. Let's write them off. And so there's the curse right there. You have to overcome this now, Gibeon. This is what we see you as. But then there's this qualification. Joshua takes what the leaders had said. You will cut wood and fetch water. But he adds to it. Joshua may have thought this as a punishment. I think I see God's sovereignty and uses it as a blessing. And actually as mercy. I'll read it again. He repeats himself. "And so we didn't want to be destroyed." Verse 26, "So he did this to them." Excuse me.
Verse 25, and now behold, this is what the people are saying to Joshua, we are in your hand, do to us what you will. So he did this to them and delivered them out of the hand of the people of God, out of Israel, and they did not kill them. But Joshua made them that day cutters of wood, drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord, to this day in the place that he should choose. So what did he do? He took them from being woodcutters and water fetchers, and he specifically said, you will do this for the whole nation, but you're definitely going to do it in the house of God. I'm going to take you from being an outsider, and I'm going to put you on the very inside of our life, our culture, and God's ways. I'm not going to make you the priests and the servants doing all of the ceremonies, but I'm going to put you right around them. You're going to come in contact with God again and again and again. You wanted to escape God's wrath, but we want you to know of God's blessing, his joy, his love, his provision, his righteousness, his faithfulness. We're going to put you right smack dab in the center of it. And so we get this interesting response in showing mercy to the world outside of us. When they come to our doorstep or when they come in contact with you, are we quick to put up a wall to say you need to jump over this before you can come? Or because of their heart wanting to know God, are we willing to bring them into the very center of our life as believers? Take communion, for instance. Essentially what Joshua told them and what God said through them, you're going to get communion ready. Now think of all the other ministries we have in church. We have children's ministry, adult ministry, we have worship up here. If someone is open to the idea of God, is searching for him, if not already open to him and willing to believe, do we normally have a line in the sand that says you need to cross this before you can step into this place of honor? Preparing to serve, preparing to worship, leading people? Obviously not up front, not the main person. Those are for the people God has raised and called and trained. Or are we more often to keep them on the outside until they're honorable before we bring them in? I think it's a unique concept when it comes to bringing people into church and getting them to be a part of the family. Bring them into what you do. Don't keep them on the outside. Here's this amazing blessing. This is the mercy. What do they deserve? To be shunned, to be kicked out. But so do we. We deserve that, but God showed his mercy towards us and put the sin of our sin on Christ and brought us a part of his family. So he places them in truly places of honor. And so we have this. What's our godly response to the world when they're open to God or open to the idea of what he's doing? Well, to be discerning about their motives and what they're trying to do. To keep our oaths. If we ever said anything to them or want to speak to them, we better keep and do what we say. We should show mercy. It's hard for us as a church. We're very judgmental. We're considered that by the outside world. We may say we're not, but if the world constantly says that we are, we have to take acknowledgement of it. There's something that we do that is judgmental, that does not show mercy. But then we come to the biggest one of all, going back. All of that is really good. Having discernment, keeping our word and showing mercy, all of that is fantastic, but it matters little if we don't consult the Lord. So last, God's people ultimately rely on God's perspective. So with this nation coming to Israel, it actually started with the Lord. The way they went about things wasn't of the Lord. Obviously, they sinned and deceived. But God was doing something in their lives. Flip with me to Joshua 11. Let's look at the full context and the weight of what's happening here. Because I think because they didn't consult God, they missed out on his blessing to be a part of this process and the restoration. Instead, they found themselves in a rock and a hard place, wondering, have we done something wrong? Are we in your will, God? Verse 15 of chapter 11 says this. Just as the Lord had commanded Moses, his servant, so Moses commanded Joshua, and Joshua did, and he left nothing undone of all that the Lord had commanded Moses. Joshua hadn't missed anything. That includes these Gibeonites. Joshua had done everything that he was commanded to do. Then look at verse 19. We see God's sovereignty. We have to acknowledge him as a part of this whole process. There was not a city that made peace with the people of Israel except the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gideon. The Israelite took the rest of them all in battle. Verse 20, for it was the Lord's doing to harden their hearts that they should come against Israel in battle in order that they should be devoted to destruction and should receive no mercy but be destroyed, just as the Lord commanded Moses. He hardened everybody else's hearts except the city of Gibeon. God was a part of this whole process. And so had the nation of Israel and Joshua consulted the Lord, what's he going to invite them in on? What's happening? Yes, the non-believers coming to the Lord are coming with what they have. It's not right. It's not good. But consulting the Lord for his perspective on the situation will ultimately bring us into the blessing of his will without wondering, am I doing the right thing? Am I saying the right thing? And so how do we consult the Lord? Well, first two are the biggest ones, prayer and reading his word. God, how do I respond to the world around me as they react to you? And there's a book called The Unchurched Next Door. And it was written about 2000, something like that, and it talks about the world outside of the church and what it's like through a Gallup poll and a survey. Most people, closer to 3/4 of the population, are open to a conversation about God. They may not want it, but they're open to it. They're not antagonistic or fighting it. Those that are, that would, if you bring up God, get very hostile, that's a small minority, about 7%. Now, that was 17 years ago. They've obviously grown, but they haven't switched. And so we come in contact with the people of the Lord. Father, how do I receive them? Specifically those who have shown some interest in the Lord. Instead of questioning and looking at all the death and the marching and the chaos and the fighting that in Joshua, someone who is hostile might say, how is that all right for God to do that? But if I were to hear someone say, how is this okay? The tone of voice, the inference is different. God, how do I respond and welcome people in? How do I respond and give you honor and give you glory? Well, he's honor and glorified if we include him and we seek his perspective. Through prayer, through reading his word, through talking with other people. And so we come to the communion today because we have been shown mercy, because God has kept his word for us. And so we get to celebrate the fact that we have been saved and we have been taken out of our sin, out of destruction, with no hope, but then slowly, over time, brought to a place of honor. The nation of Gibeon, that city before the temple was built, became a real center for worship for the whole nation of Israel. That people took what was a curse, and God used it for a blessing.